that makes me know that we had the right idea in the beginning, and we just need to maintain our focus and elevate. We update our formulas. We have certain formulas, but we update them with the times and everything, you know. And so.
Hello, my basketball friends, and welcome to the Teardrop Runners. This is the weekly internet show where four old friends from Seattle get together and try to learn something about the emerging field of basketball analytics. I'm your host in a rainy Baltimore, and with us, as always, are...
Manziel Beasy Blakely in Brownstone, Brooklyn. Bruh.
Chris Breezy Brown.
I didn't know you were called Breezy.
I'm Breezy, man.
Who put that in the script?
I did. That's me, man. I put it in.
That's great. It's,
my evil twin goes by Breezy, so I've decided to adopt it for myself.
Okay, all right. I like it. It's exciting.
And of course, by evil twin, I mean the guy that formerly dated Rihanna.
No, currently dates Rihanna.
So currently did.
Yeah. We're going to stay away from that. We're not Seth MacFarlane here.
Yeah.
We're not going to court controversy. Speaking of which, Manziel, did you enjoy the Oscars? No. I'm sure you spent the entire evening in a tuxedo.
I watched the red carpet for the first time in my life.
Okay.
I was blown away by the weirdness of it all and by Renee Zellweger's face.
Did you see that little Kristen Chenoweth person?
Yes. Candace has met Kristen Chenoweth.
What is she famous from? I don't know her.
She's famous from Broadway, but she was also on a short-lived NBC program called GCB, among others.
GCB? What's GCB stand for?
It's unreleased, the actual title.
Imagine. No, I can't imagine GCB.
this is
Christ Boy.
Crazy
Good
Oscar
Christian
story.
Bells.
Oh, okay.
Two of Cheryl's classmates were in the Oscars.
Wow.
Yeah. One of them she went to Europe with for, like, 2 months.
Wow, that's exciting. Cheryl, of course, is one of our executive producers. We are missing, in case you haven't noticed, we've been trying to cover up for it with some witty banter, but we're missing our fourth member tonight, Rob. He has one of the flus that's going around, and he has not left his bed in the last 20... Now we're looking at 28 hours, so... CDC's on high alert, but we hope he feels better. So, it is, of course, suspicious that he did that on a week when we assigned pretty boring homework. That's a classic maneuver. If that is, in fact, what's going on, hats off to you, Rob. all right, well, we did all decide to read one of the papers that was presented at this weekend's Sloan Sports Analytics Conference about the NBA. So let's recap a few of those now. Chris, what was the article that you read about and who wrote it?
Right. I read about a paper on acceleration in the NBA. It was by a gentleman by the name Philip Maimon, who teaches at NYU Polytechnic Institute.
NYU Poly.
Poly.
I think it's actually a junior college that feeds into Rider University.
Is that with a Y or an R? That sounds like Manhattan elitism, because where is Brooklyn Poly, Manziel?
NYU Poly is in Brooklyn.
Oh, I gave it away by saying Brooklyn Poly.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Yeah, so it's got totally legit street cred as far as these things are concerned.
It is one of the... Central Brooklyn's top traffic engineering schools.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's Central Brooklyn, huh?
Yeah.
It's a hotbed for traffic. I know, I've gotten stuck in it there before.
So what's this paper about, Chris?
Anyway, so this guy accesses video data from previous NBA seasons and is able to track the position of players relative to a stationary features on the court, and from this information he can predict acceleration of different players. And
the technology that we're talking about is this. You'll hear it, I think, in at least a couple of our papers. Is called the Sports View technology, which is basically a new private business that contracts with a number of NBA teams to give them this kind of data. And has given some academics and journalists access to some of this stuff.
Yeah. And so he, from this information, he figures out what areas on the court players accelerate in or decelerate in. And he also figures out which players move fast and which ones move slow. And it's actually a really – it's an interesting idea. It turns out that in basketball, I'm not sure that there's I'm not sure that the findings are particularly meaningful. He finds out that players accelerate a lot when they're in the key and when they're in the elbow. He doesn't say why this happens, but to me, it's I think that those are the places where basically guys are either coming off of a pick and roll or they're basically moving rapidly towards the hoop to get a play over another player or to get a bucket over another player or to stop that. So it's not that that's maybe not a particularly interesting finding. He also discovers which players accelerate a lot and which don't. And the thing that stands out there is that some good players accelerate a lot, some bad players accelerate a lot, and that's also true for guys that don't accelerate a lot. So, for example, one of the guys that's good that accelerates a lot is Tyson Chandler, Taj Gibson, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, guys that accelerate a lot that maybe aren't known to be particularly good players are Chris Humphreys, Solomon Alibi, who I actually Ooh. I've never heard of before, and then guys that are infrequent accelerators, of course, is Mark Gasol.
You're
talking
Mark.
You guys are accelerator.
Yeah, that would be a great
band. Something that caused for a recall.
Mark Gasol, yeah. Is an infrequent accelerator.
You know, he's a guy. Of course, like looking at him, you know that that's the case, right? You know that.
Infrequent.
Yeah. So, Chris, if do these findings kind of jive with our mental image of players? For example, if I look up Andre Miller, am I going to find a guy who doesn't accelerate that much?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, I'd say one. I'm looking at some of these lists. One of the guys that's listed as another infrequent accelerator is Chandler Parsons, who's it's an interesting case because you expect someone who runs the floor that much and, you know, certainly is a part of a lot of fast breaks to have a higher acceleration rate. Is it maybe that he just reaches his top speed pretty quickly and is pretty fast in general?
It's so with Chandler Parsons, like what I see him doing a lot is he's a guy that's spotting up for three on offense a lot.
Loading.
And so he's basically looking to catch and shoot. And so on offense, he's maybe not moving that much. On defense, he's probably moving, but I'm not sure that his movement on defense is enough to kind of raise his overall percentage up that high.
Okay. So even though he's a fast player, I think most people would describe him as fast because he spends so much time, as Menzel says, floating on offense. His percentage of acceleration just goes down by nature of the way he plays the game. Right?
That's true. I also don't know. I mean, he may not be a fast player. I mean, we see that his overall plus and minus numbers are pretty bad. Like, he's actually quite negative, which makes me think that he's just getting scorched on D, which makes me think that he may not be, while we're seeing a lot of work effort from him, he might be like me on the ultimate field, not moving that quickly, but sweating a lot and kind of flailing and things like that.
I don't know. I definitely see him running past guys. I see him running the fast break pretty well, but I don't know any of his times.
Okay. The other kind of part of this analysis is this guy actually threw out all the data for fast breaks. So he really only recorded.
Now you're talking.
He recorded kind of his analysis of acceleration happened only in half-court sets.
I see. So it's sort of an analysis of within the half-court set, who's good at sort of those quick – it's really about
it's really
quick
like
bursts.
One, two steps, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I would be interested to see if they could come up with a finding that matches generally our perceptions on who's a really good perimeter defender, like shutting down drives, Is there a guy out there that can shut down D. Rose when he's isolated at the top of the key?
That would be interesting. I'll bet there is such a paper. So, Chris, let me ask you this question. This is an interesting idea, and I'm sure there might be useful, maybe strategic things we can learn from this, but from a player evaluation standpoint or from kind of a general lesson standpoint, Does this paper tell us very much about how we watch the game?
In my view, not really. I mean, I think that we don't see real strong correlations between how good a player is at basketball and their acceleration necessarily. And so I don't find it particularly informative in the basketball world. I think that if were this the writer able to repeat this type of analysis with football, that would be very different. My suspicion is that actually sort of speed and acceleration on the football field really do correlate with true talent, and that you know, that type of information is rare and hard to find, and that were he to do this in that sport, this would be would really help teams identify talent.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Manziel?
Yes.
You were reading a paper about crashing the boards, right?
Crash or not to crash.
To crash or not to crash. That's adapted, I believe, from an old Mel Brooks movie title.
Yeah. So the idea is, this is an eternal basketball idea, I think.
Eternal.
How hard should you try to get offensive rebounds? You know, the trade-off is, do you go for the offensive rebound and try to get that, or do you try to get back on D and prevent the next point?
Right.
So these guys use that same sports view data to determine, one, how frequently teams crashed or didn't crash. Secondly, how often teams not crashed, but had guys retreat, that is, proactively get back on D after a shot. And then broke down the kind of the point differential. So, you know, the points scored on offensive rebounds and eventual scores versus the points allowed on the ensuing defensive position when they don't get the rebound.
Okay. So, and is the idea that they're trying to reach a conclusion that one is generally better than the other, or is it a more refined question than that?
In a way, that is the question. What's the best kind of ratio of guys crashing to guys retreating? They recognize some drawbacks is that you're not understanding why a guy is crashing. Is he crashing because he sees an open lane to the hoop, or because the guy that is set to box him out is smaller, or are they retreating for the opposite reasons? So the decision making process isn't looked into. And I don't think that's really possible with this video data either. So
have they thought about just turning up defense, offensive reboarding, rebounding in NBA 2K13 to 100? I think if you did that, I'm sure SportsCenter would try that.
Yeah. They stop short of saying this is the better tactic, but they do show that in practice there is the most optimal and least optimal configuration of guys crashing versus guys retreating.
And what's optimal?
Yeah.
Tell us.
So
hit us with the optimal, dog.
The first thing to remember is that no matter what, if you miss a shot, you're likely to end up losing the battle between two possessions. So I'll start off with the least optimal, which is to retreat all four guys and send nobody to crash the boards. In this case, your team will somehow still rebound the ball 4% of the time, offensive rebound the ball 0.4% of the time, but in general, you will lose out by over 1 point between the next two possessions, so negative 1.08.
That's a pretty big swing, actually.
That is, considering that a team is going to miss 30 or 40 shots in a game. The most optimal is the exact opposite end of the spectrum. It's sending three guys to crash the boards, and sending one player back to retreat.
Someone should send this to Lorenzo Romar.
Yeah, I think that's how he plays.
He'll be like, "I knew this the whole time.
The best results and the highest chances of getting an offensive rebound, 40%, are when you send three guys to crash and nobody retreating. Your offensive rebounding does go down a little bit if you send one player to retreat. However, because of presumably the extra defense afforded by having a player retreat, you actually only lose out by 0.09 points per possession in that situation. So that's the most optimal.
So, I mean, one, I mean, that's pretty interesting, actually, because that seems to go against the trend that I'm seeing. I mean, this is an absolute trend in college basketball now, and I would say a fairly strong trend in the NBA, which is that a lot of good teams don't go hard after the offensive boards. And so is this article saying that kind of prevailing basketball wisdom right now is wrong?
You know, they don't get into anything about the actual tactics, you know, as to what teams are playing or what the trends are.
Yeah. Can I tell you what my theory is about that, about why that's the case?
Yeah.
In some ways, it's I think that teams are getting smarter about defense, and they're realizing that with some of these like really good athletes, you know, they may not be able to get their finesse down on offense as quickly, but if you teach them these defensive principles. And I think like the Tom Thibodeau Boston Celtics system has taken hold. I don't really watch college basketball, as you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, for instance, in the NBA, the famous example of a team that gets back instead of offensive rebounding is the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of that's age, obviously. But I also think that some of that has to do with the fact that their defensive scheme, and I'm sorry to any Boston listeners on the off chance we have any, their defensive scheme is basically just to foul constantly and dare the refs to blow the whistle. So they get off with a lot of chippy fouls. A lot of their fouling has to do with just getting position and kind of chipping guys as they come through.
Mm.
So getting set up on defense is really important to their general game plan.
Yeah.
And that might not apply across the board.
I'm going to go ahead and have another theory, is that the third crasher, you know, typically your power forward and your center are going to be down there getting those boards frequently in any scenario. That third guy who's going to be a wing player is probably going in. He's in the best position to see like a wide open lane and not get boxed out,
yeah,
and to kind of poach these rebounds. So there's a big selection bias when we get to those three crasher scenarios.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, and just to give everyone an idea of kind of the universe of this data, there's about 110 games or so from the 2011-2012 season. So not every team is included in this data, so there's some sampling issues, of course, but the numbers for the all those that I gave you were there's at least 100 observations.
Okay. Well, board view may be the future.
This is interesting. I'm curious to see if people try to change it up after hearing about this.
Well, I mean, there's so many variables, though. I mean, that third person makes a big difference, and your team's defensive capabilities make a big difference. I mean, there's so many variables that go into that decision. That being said, a 1-point swing is pretty huge. You'd agree with that.
Yeah, and this is also, you know, a lot of times, you know, this new statistical data that crops up really supports kind of the way smart coaches play, but this is actually, you know, I think a new finding that counteracts conventional wisdom, and so it's an opportunity for a smart team to maybe do something different.
Hammer the boards. What's George Karl doing, Scott?
George Karl is hammering the boards, my friends.
Yeah.
You better believe it. George Karl has offensive rebounding set to 11. And it's working.
What'd you read, dude?
It's working. I read an article called The Dwight Effect. By the way, did you tell us the authors? I want to give those authors credit as we took their ideas apart without actually having you being the only one that actually read the article.
The paper is written by some MIT graduate and doctoral students.
Sorry, guys. Sorry if we butchered any of your ideas. We don't know what we're doing.
I like the picture of Joel Brooks.
It's a nice picture. It's cut off a little bit.
Yeah, no need to get the chin in the shot.
I don't know. We want to be mocking this PhD.
Yeah. Joel.
Yeah. Cool, Joel.
Joel Brooks of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
We'll edit this part out. All right. I'm sorry that I asked any of us to identify the authors of their papers. I wrote a paper called the other guys were there were Jenna Wines, Guha Balakrishnan, Joel Brooks, and John Gutag.
Balakrishnan.
Thanks, guys. Mm. Balakrishnan. I apologize. Thank you, Mint.
You're welcome.
So my article, the article that I looked at, I won't say I read it. I mean, there were some parts I didn't read. You know, it got slow in the middle. Some of the characters I didn't care for.
Sometimes it's long. They got a lot of words.
It was like the Royal Tannenbaum.
They can be big words,
it's
too.
It's bogged down in the middle for me. Yeah. But, no.
Hardly any sex.
This article is called The Dwight Effect. It is the Dwight Effect. I'll just get that spoiler out of the way right away. The Dwight Effect refers to the fact that looking through Sports View at the 2011-2012 season, they showed that there was an 11% drop in the percentage of shots that the opposing team took at or near the rim, basically being close to the basket within 7 feet of the rim, which is a pretty dramatic drop-off. Basically, you're talking about that interior section being by far the highest percentage shot in the NBA for any player at any position at any time.
And he got it on lockdown.
Yep, and he locked that. People were afraid to come in there.
Yep.
So, you know, the idea is basically that we don't know that much about defensive stats. We really, in basketball, it's the baseball's beginning to come along, but in basketball, we really don't have very much. So the Kirk Goldsberry and Eric Weiss, I don't know, I apologize. If he's listening to this, please correct me. But anyway, what they did was they looked at a few different effects that an interior defender could have on a shot. So that being one of them, but the other ones being the field goal percentage of the other team when the player is within 5 feet of the basket. So just generally, how are they affecting the other team's field goal percentage when they're near the rim? The field goal percentage when the defender is within 5 feet of the shot and the shot is close to the basket. So basically, how is he affecting shots at the rim? Just in addition to generally affecting the field goal percentage. And then, how close does the defender get to his shooter? And what's the overall percentage of the opposing player when the defender is within 5 feet of him? So basically the idea is that they use this new sports view technology to break the court up into different zones so they can actually get this information. The player with the worst, this was my favorite, the player with the worst, lowest frequency of being close to shots, Tyler Hansborough was within 5 feet of the shots of the player he was guarding only 20% of the time.
He's one of those guys you stick your stretch four on, right?
Yeah, I think you can pretty much stick anyone on him at this point, as long as a person's not a small, like a John Brockman type that's just kind of trying to power through him.
Yeah.
Anybody fast, you can stick on him.
Yeah.
But you know what's interesting is that in some of these ratings, there are some kind of standout surprises. So, for instance, when you're looking at shots faced when the defender was close to the shooter, the number of shots that a guy is close, like within 5 feet of the shooter.
Yeah.
This is based on the defender, right?
Right, exactly. Sorry. Gotcha. So the shots that were faced when the guy that we're talking about, the defender here in this case, number one is Josh Harrelson, was within 5 feet of the shooter.
And so the guys are not respecting Josh Harrelson, no matter how close he
is. I guess that's right.
That's possible, yeah. Was he, do you have the information that, according to that metric, is he effective?
Oh, man. So many good times are generated, through technology.
That's true.
In any case, there's a lot of numbers here. Look, I got a stack of documents. Right. I'm starting to sweat like a witness at a deposition. I'm going to throw these papers away. It's much too complicated to get into. I just wanted to introduce you guys to that idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, you should read the paper because it's got a lot of pretty pictures. That's why I chose it. Then it turned out there were four appendices, and I should have called in sick like Rob did because I obviously got lost. But, you know, I will say one of the interesting metrics in here is a proximal field goal percentage, which is the relative efficiencies of shooters in proximity of the defender. So that is which defenders are – decreasing their opponent's field goal percentage the most. And number one was Larry Sanders. This is, again, last season. Number two was, do you want to guess, Chris?
I can't guess who. So he's probably an awesome defender.
You're right. It's Andrea Bargnani.
What?
So, you know, this is – that's – you would think that that at least would give you some indication, the approximate field goal percentage. You know, it's not necessarily something that favors big men, because at the bottom five, you've got Anderson Varejao, Jordan Hill, and David Lee. Now, of course, this we're basically looking at guys that generally are playing around the rim. But still, that's a pretty dramatic difference. So,
is Dwight on the list somewhere?
Of course Dwight's on the list. Let me look at that appendices. Thanks for asking more follow-up questions, Menzel. Hey,
good question.
proximal field goal percentage.
You know, this does, you know, while you're looking, looking for Dwight, this does remind me of the analysis that somebody did either last year or the year before that said one of the best things you can do when you play defense is hold your hands in the air.
That reminds me of the Onion study that said that college drinking is fucking awesome research finds. Dwight Howard is 15th behind such defensive luminaries as Nazir Muhammad, Jan Mahimi, and Andres Beatriz. Now, and JaVale McGee, of course, at number 11. So
bench players.
But, you know, again, the paper's not trying to make the case that any one of these defensive metrics is something you just look at a list. It's sort of a bunch of different information points about a defender. Mm. So I think it's a good start to the extent that I understand it. And I did enjoy the pretty pictures. So thank you, Kirk Goldsberry. Now, a lot of people have said that Dwight Howard and the Lakers' defense are the reason that they're losing. When you're kind of looking at the Lakers from a numbers perspective, Manziel, it seems like they have a couple of things going for them. What's like the main argument you hear people try to defend the Lakers and say they're going to make the playoffs?
Well, I'll forgo the most common argument I hear, but I will say, just
what's
looking
that,
at
Kobe?
Numbers. Kobe. Yeah,
sorry, it. I meant the most frequent numbers-based argument.
You know, this year's Lakers do have a positive point differential. You know, I went ahead and plugged the Lakers' numbers. They're at 28-32 games under 500 with a plus 0.9 points per game margin. I plugged that into the old Pythagorean theorem, and I found that they've been unlucky by about 4 wins. So they should probably be around 32-26.
Now, when you say Pythagorean theorem, you're talking about a squared plus b squared equals c squared, right?
Yeah, basically the old triangle theorem.
Okay.
That you might remember from elementary school.
So, you know, my experience with the Pythagorean theorem in sports has to do with Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
And basically, folks, you know, maybe 10 years ago, figured out that they could basically predict how many wins a team should have based on the number of runs that a team scores and the number of runs a team prevents. So, for example, if the Yankees last year scored 1,000 runs and prevented or had 800 runs scored on them, they're plus 200, and that should equal some kind of number of wins. And that for basically that ratio is very predictive for wins for every team and across different seasons.
Yeah. So, you know, the purpose of, I think this came about because, you know, baseball is a sport where teams will score a vastly different amount of runs from game to game. They'll shut out one day, score 8. And, you know, sometimes you'll win a game 1-0, then lose a game 7-8. So they wanted to you know, filter that out. Since one offensive team doesn't impact the other, it's kind of luck. And so the idea was to figure out how good teams really are based on their run scoring and run prevention rather than the records. So they do this in basketball as well. But one of the differences with basketball versus baseball is that teams tend to be much more consistent in the number of points they score. And also the margin of victory in a basketball game is very small compared to baseball. So if you think about baseball, a regular score might be 5-4. You know, that's a 20% difference in runs scored between the winning team and the losing team. In basketball, that's like, you know, that'd be 80 to 96 gains. So it's like a near blowout at 20%. So in order to use that Pythagorean theorem, you actually have to use a little bit different version of it, which, you know, obviously it's not as simple. You can't really do it in your head like you can with the baseball stats. But
so Manziel, is this something that other people have done, or you just figured this out yourself?
Oh, no. This is Daryl Morey actually was one of the pioneers of this. John Hollinger does this as well.
Okay.
It's one of the things that Hollinger uses as part of the base for his playoff odds, actually. But anyways, to just get right to the formula, you know, in baseball, it's basically acceptable to use to raise everything to the power of 2. So runs scored squared over runs scored squared plus runs allowed scored. In basketball, you have to use a much higher exponent. So you run those to anywhere between 13.9 and 15. You raise those to a very high power. Mm. Basically what that does
it's very important to acknowledge a high power.
Yes. The higher power.
Yeah.
It basically just it serves to accentuate the difference between the scores. So in basketball, a 90 to 80 game is a pretty convincing victory. Percentage wise, it's relatively small, so you gotta pump that up a little bit to really show how strong a team is. And this is all determined through past records. So it's not a guess. It's based on, you know, what fits the data the best.
Okay. So I'm actually, you know, I actually have a kind of a few beefs with the Pythagorean theorem with respect to basketball. I'm not sure that it translates as readily to this sport as it does to baseball. But basically, kind of some of my complaints about using Pythagorean theorem to sort of predict winning percentage in basketball is that it doesn't account for strengths of schedule in basketball. So in basketball, basically, we've seen historically, at least over the last few years, that Eastern Conference teams just aren't as good as Western Conference teams. And so if you're a team in the East, you're going to play the majority of your schedule or more games against your foes in the East, and you're going to have a weaker schedule. And so, you know, you could basically win or dominate, you know, in the East, and then when you go West, have a much harder time winning. So I think that the Pythagorean theorem or whatever with respect to this game doesn't account for that strength of schedule difference. Another difference is that this is a statistical approach that really relies upon sort of a large sample size and kind of a Gaussian or some kind of normal distribution of events. You know, I'm not sure that we have enough events in basketball to really to say that, you know, that we can predict, you know, based on past things, what's going to happen in the future. And then the third point is that basketball teams and GMs and coaches really change how they approach games depending on the season. Basketball is, or where they're at in the season. So basketball is a sport where a GM could go from trying to win a championship in the first half of the season to trying to lose every game in the second half. And so it really throws off the assumption that you have that every team approaches the game the same way every time and they're all trying to win, I think is really suspect in basketball just because of the value of tanking in the sport.
Well, here's the question. So you're talking about the number of events. And it sort of assumes that one game is one event. But in some ways, it seems to me that what this theory is at least trying to account for is that you could view the each minute as an event or each quarter as an event. You still have a ton of basketball that's been played, and you do still have a kind of a total point differential or an average point differential. I mean, Manziel, does this have a track record of success at predicting future records?
You know, I don't know that it does, but I'm pretty confident that it does. You know, it's based on the idea that teams that outscore other teams on the whole tend to win more often than not. So and just as a baseline idea, it's very strong.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. I agree with that. I mean, I agree with that 100%, right? I mean, teams that score a lot of points and stop the other team from scoring a lot of points, they're going to do well. And the reverse is true, too. But you know, I think it breaks down a little bit where you look at into the past, sort of your example about how, oh, you know, the Lakers scored more points than they gave up, you know, in the first half of the season. Therefore, in the second half, you know, their luck should change and they should, you know, maybe get some wins that maybe they shouldn't get. or they wouldn't. Basically, they can earn back those wins that they lost in the first half. I'm not really sure that's going to happen in basketball because of the length of the season and the fact that the way GMs and coaches approach the game is so volatile.
You know, I actually really appreciate that argument. It's something that, you know, I kind of wonder about how could you control for that type of thing where, you know, some teams are tanking, some teams are resting their starters. You know, it's, you know, things like that that do add a new wrinkle besides just kind of the basic math of the Pythagorean theorem.
So under the Pythagorean theorem, the Lakers should have a winning percentage right now, correct?
They should have a above 500 winning percentage.
But it still wouldn't put them in the playoffs, right?
It would put them in the playoffs. They would be in the number 7 spot. So Golden State and Utah right now, who are both in the playoffs as of right now, do have negative scoring differentials.
So here's a stats question for you.
Yeah.
So based on the Pythagorean theorem, like what we know about the Lakers in the first half of the season, what do you expect them to do in the second half?
So they have played now, it looks like, 58 games. So they have 24 games left. I'm going to say that by the Pythagorean record, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, I'm not running the math, they should win 14 of those games. So if you go 14-10 or 13-11 the rest of the way, that put them at 42 or 41 wins.
So are you assuming that they will win games at the clip that they should have won them in the first half of the season?
No, they're not going to like mystically make up those lost wins through the concept of Pythagorean wins. So what this does
you're not predicting a regression in this case. You're just predicting that they should win at the percentage that they ought to have in the first half.
In this case, it is a regression to the mean. In this case, it's positive, though.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yep.
So, you know, I think that, you know, their pass record is set. There's nothing they can do about their pass record.
Right.
If they play the way that they have played over the entire season, they are likely to finish right around 500 and have a winning record from this point out.
Okay. But they're not necessarily going to regress to sort of a greater number of wins in the second half because they had a worse in the first half.
Yeah, so those extra losses they piled up, that's just bad news.
Yeah, water into the bridge.
Past is prologue, my friends.
Yep.
That's an expression.
An expression. No, I'm just trying to figure out if this expression applies.
The season just started today, man.
That's never heard it before.
Tell themselves right after every loss.
Yeah.
Okay, I gotta break that down statistically.
Whether they've been...
not over the next week. But go ahead.
Yeah, please crunch the numbers on that one. All right. So, are there any other kind of weird anomalies in the looking at Pythagorean wins and playoffs that we want to talk about here before we wrap up?
I mean, this is just a challenge for everybody. I don't have the answer to this, but
I do not accept your challenge.
My my feeling is that the Pythagorean type approach, you know, works really well for larger statistical sample sizes, and that it kind of begins to fall apart over smaller sample sizes. So, for example, you know, works pretty well for baseball, works less well for basketball. I don't think it works at all for football.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my question is...
What's got less games than football? Is there anything with less games than football?
Maybe professional wrestling? Cricket? I don't know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my question is, why is that? Why does the you know, is it just, you know, we look at the outcomes and the outcomes are so small in number they appear more volatile, or I don't have the answer to this, but my thought is that
what's your challenge? What's the challenge?
So why does this appear to be the case? Am I not interpreting the data correctly? Is it apply equally regardless of sample size, or is it an issue where you get one number plus or minus some error bar?
Yeah.
That I'm not, you know, I haven't actually calculated any of this, so maybe I don't know what the error bars are. And
what's an error bar?
It's
a standard deviation.
Well,
it's
it gives you a range of values that may happen. for an event.
Sorry,
so for example,
I already fell asleep while you were talking.
Yeah.
let's move on. That was a bad question.
No, no, no.
That was a bad question.
Good question. Actually. Excellent question.
I thought it was a skate trick. I was kind of excited for a second.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Man, imagine how excited Pythagoras was when he discovered the triangle. He must have been pumped, right?
The triangle offense?
The triangle. Mr. Pythagoras, the discoverer of the triangle.
Oh, yeah.
That was a great day for America. I believe. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. If my history classes taught me anything.
The Greek part of it.
All right, guys. Well, I think that's all the analysis we have for tonight. If you're out there on the internet, which you must be, or else how did you get this? I didn't send you a tape of this. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Teardrop Runners, or you can email us at theteardroprunners@gmail.com. Leave comments for us on our blog, which is over at teardrop.urbanishment.com. And Menzel, I believe we have a viewer contest. Is that right? A viewer contest for our listeners?
We're at a viewer contest. This is engaging in my own geekery. Every week I pick an outro song and a couple pictures to put on the blog post for the podcast. So the viewer challenge is to, one, identify the song I use at the end of each podcast, and two, to identify the connection between what we talk about on the podcast and the image used on the blog. You give me those, and I will give you a shout-out from the DJ booth at the club.
All right, man. Sweet. Well, if we get more than 5 entries in that contest, I will...
Can podcast members join the contest?
No.
No? Okay.
No. Right. Did you see this week's? Last week's we had James Spader's version of Crash, which was not the Crash that we were talking about on the show, but was very clever.
That's correct.
And then I forgot what I remember what the other image meant, but I forgot what it was. So anyway, that's something for y'all to figure out this week. That's our version of our puzzle. And until next time, you guys want to say goodnight?
Good night, y'all. My name's Breezy.
Good night, Breezy.
Good night, guys.
And until next time, save us a seat at the next Sonics game.
See ya.
Me.